Hi, everybody. My name is Irene, and I'm an alcoholic. It is good to be here, and thanks for that introduction. And I'm so grateful that you read that beforehand, because it just settles me and reminds me again of how grateful I am to be sober today. My sobriety date is January 22nd, 2010. My home group is the Elkton Group, which meets on Sunday nights at 7 p.m. I believe it's the Christian Brethren's Church. It is a discussion meeting, and the last Sunday of the month, we have a speaker meeting, followed that by potluck. Any of you are in the area, come. I chose that meeting to be my home group because, number one, of the laughter in that group. Many of you know Rick, and Rick is a guy that has really good sobriety, and he has a great sense of humor. And I just love the fellowship there. It's a great group. So please come. You're welcome. I wanted to start telling you what it was like kind of in the middle. I just want to get all of that out there to kind of, you know, just set the stage what got me into Alcoholics Anonymous. Around 1980, 1981, I was living in Montclair, New Jersey, in a boarding house, a good old-fashioned boarding house with a shared bath and old rickety furniture and old TV in the living room, musty smelling. And I had just landed a good job in a pharmaceutical company in Nutley, New Jersey. And I got a job as an executive secretary, had benefits, 401k, medical coverage. And I was grounded in that. I was very, very grateful for that. Up until that time, I had kind of bounced around from boyfriend to boyfriend, living in boyfriend's parents' basement, just kind of like living, you know, from one situation to another. And I managed to find a job that kind of got me a little bit more rooted and grounded. Both my parents passed away in my early 20s. So for a good portion, of my life at that time, I was an orphan, you know, at 21 years old, and kind of on my own and kind of lost. So anyway, I was working at this pharmaceutical company, and I was at the copy machine, and I looked up, and there was the most handsome guy I had ever seen. Jim Minecki, 6'2", beautiful Polish guy, dark hair, bright green eyes, three-piece suit. It was back in the day when executives wore the three-piece suit, gray suit with the pink tie, the vest. And I tell you, we looked at each other from across the room, and it was like bells and whistles went off. It was one of those deals. At the time, I was in the process of getting a divorce from my first husband. So being the good moral girl that I was, I said, we cannot date until I get a divorce. So that happened, and we dated and we got married. But I want to tell you the type of person that he married. I was like the character in the children's book, If You Give a Mouse a Cookie. I don't know if any of you have heard of that. If you give a mouse a cookie, they will want a glass of milk. That pretty much was my personality. I was vain. I was attractive, and I knew I was attractive. Vain, fearful, low self-esteem, selfish, and self-centered, and easily bruised, very defensive. That's what I kind of presented to him, a teenager. On the surface, I was a catch. However, I don't think he knew what he was in for. There was a lot of hysteria in our relationship, a lot of him chasing me and dragging me back because he wanted the prize. So he got her. And the whole thing of, I went to a wonderful AA Al-Anon gathering yesterday, and we were talking about just that cookie personality. And this one gal said, I want what I want, and I want it now. That was me. And she said that, I want what I want, and I want it now. kind of sounds like wah, 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 doesn't it? You know, I'm going, oh yeah. And I married a person who gave, gave, gave. If I wanted, he gave. That was his way of showing that he loved me. But I was off and running with that. And that obsession to get, and this will make me happy, was kind of like the running thread through our marriage. We lived the good life. Like I said, my husband was an executive for a good company. He was being groomed to be moved up the ladder. I remember he showed me a picture of himself when we first started dating, and he was getting ready to get up, to get on the company jet to fly out to Arizona. I was like, holy moly, you know, you picked moi, you know? So like I said, when our kids were born, we traveled, we went on all the best vacations. We had the house on the hill with the swimming pool, with, we had a boat, we had a rabbit, we had two dogs, we had a kitty cat, we had trampoline, quads, half pipe. I mean, every toy imaginable. And we had the life. My drinking, and we drank together. It was part of our social, you know, our social thing. We'd have friends over, we would drink, vacations, holidays, all those things, all involved drinking. But what happened was, as my kids grew older, I had a lot more time on my hands. When they were in high school, I was spending more and more time. I was a stay-at-home mom, and I had more and more time on my hands. And my drinking increased. And what happened was, I noticed that my drinking habits were changing. For instance, we would have company over for a barbecue, and I would excuse myself from what was going on outside, go into the kitchen, open the fridge, and power drink. We used to buy those big bottles of Chardonnay. I was a wine drinker. And I would chug, put it back in the fridge and go back out, because everybody out on the porch could not keep up with what I needed. It was, I felt that obsession and compulsion taking over my drinking. Or if we had, my husband was the Bahama Mama master, but he would make them so everybody could have a good time. And I would get so upset with him because he didn't make them strong enough. I wanted everybody to party like I party. And I would go in after he had made a batch and sneak some more rum in. I noticed that there was, I just felt in my heart that this was not normal. And even we had friends, our friends, Chuck and Diane. Chuck was a foodie, and he loved good wine, and he loved good alcohol, and he loved his dirty martinis, and he would get into arguments with his neighbors about what the perfect olive was to put in a drink. Do you put the blue cheese? Do you buy this blue cheese? And blah, blah, blah. And he loved to prepare all these really great meals, and he thought himself a wine connoisseur. So one night we were going over there to visit them and have drinks and everything before dinner. And I thought, oh my God, we're going to have to sit and look at this glass of wine, have it 3/4 full, look at it, look at the color, admire it, taste it, blah, blah, blah. And all I wanted to do was get loaded, you know? So the way I fixed that problem was, I got a tumbler, put 2 ice cubes in it, filled it up with Chardonnay so that I could get a good buzz on before we got there. And then I found, in subsequent times visiting them, I would sneak into their refrigerator and chug wine out of the refrigerator. We went to visit our good friends, Dale and Linda, in Forked River, New Jersey. And I was doing the same to them. And I think of that now, and I think, holy, my son caught me once doing that. And he said, Mom, easy, killer, you know? But when I think of that today, I mean, that behavior was crazy. It was crazy. If they had walked in and seen me doing that, insanity. So the obsession and the compulsion to drink was just really, really taking over. I did things like, I did pass out my mashed potatoes and my husband had to carry me upstairs. And the remarks started coming from him, "Honey, you always drink for effect. Can we just go out and just have a glass of wine?" Never could I understand that. And I was getting angry at him for being a wet blanket. And I wanted to say, "Well, why don't you just get off your high horse and just party?" You know? So it was starting to cause all kinds of problems. Or this, "Honey, when you go out to check on the kids, could you put the wine glass down?" And so he was starting to notice it. I was certainly starting to notice it, but it went on. And it was a Father's Day weekend. We had my in-laws over for the weekend for Father's Day. They were going to stay over. And that Sunday, my daughter was in a piano recital, and she was the oldest student in the class and the most accomplished. And she was very, very good. And there was a lot of excitement in our home. Her grandparents, she was playing a piece by Chopin, and any good Polish person's like, "All right, you know, we're going to hear some good Polish classical music." So grandmom and grandpa were really proud. We were proud of her. And we were really looking forward to that. And that night, Saturday night, we allowed the kids to have some of their friends over. We had a detached garage, and on the other side of the garage, there was a fire pit. And we allowed the kids to kind of hang out there, you know, kind of away from the adults, and have their friends and, you know, have their party out there. And there were two boys that showed up that broke into our garage and took a gas can out of the garage, and they were filling soda bottles, you know, like the plastic 2-liter soda bottles, with gas, lighting them, putting a paper towel or whatever they were putting in them, and then stomping on them on the grass to see the flames shoot out. We were unaware of this at the time, what was going on. What happened was one of the kids got in the way, and the flame shot up the front of his body, burned his neck, and he inhaled the flames, and he nearly died. He had to be rushed to our local school about 3 miles down the road, where he was airlifted to a burn unit in Doylestown, Pennsylvania, I believe it was. And he was in a coma for a couple of weeks. And that was on our watch. Now, my drinking was escalating. I was getting a reputation in the area. My husband was on the board of education. So our family was being talked about. And there were other occasions where neighbors and friends came over, and, you know, like 2 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon in August, I was trashed. So there was talk, and there was a lot of talk about, this happened on our watch. Were they drunk? Was I drunk? And because I was drinking more and more, becoming more and more alienated from my husband and my family, I wasn't present for them anymore, that the guilt, the overwhelming guilt that I caused this, was being shoved down, and I was just pouring more alcohol on top of it. And then all the fear of, are we going to be sued? Are we going to be arrested? Is this kid going to live? And his parents and how they were affected. It's a very dark day. And I remember a dark year. It just took a long time to walk out of this whole situation. Mm-hmm. And the next day, the piano recital, we had to make a decision if we were going to go or not, because everything was touch and go with this young man in the hospital. We decided to go. When we walked into that auditorium, and it was much bigger than this, not one neighbor spoke to us or even acknowledged us. We were like the pariahs of the community. It was a very, very dark time. So, and right about that time, you know, we kind of walked through that, and we're kind of starting to recover from that. My husband had talked a long time for taking a package from his job and buying a business, and us going into business together. Not the best decision, you know, with all the turmoil going on, my drinking starting to really be out of control. We went and bought a marina in upstate New York. Wow. And sold the house, downsized all our belongings, and off we went to upstate New York. Keep in mind, my drinking's increasing. Our marriage is not the greatest. And this is where we ended up. Well, it went from bad to worse. We managed to hold on to that business for roughly 12 years. And my drinking just kept getting worse and worse and worse. And I just have to say this the way it was. When I was a little girl, my heroes were people like the March sisters in Little Women. I loved Tom Sawyer, Huckleberry Finn, and I absolutely loved and adored Florence Nightingale. I read her story. And I wanted to go to the Crimea War and roll bandages. I mean, I was just so in love with her, and just the thought of creating something to help somebody. At the end of my drinking, my hero was Anna Nicole Smith. That's what I had become, from this kind, sensitive, emotional, passionate young girl with all these dreams. I ended up where I was, and I was bewildered. When I made it into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and again, I'm a visual person, and I was really thinking about this. And you all, I'm sure most of you have seen the movie The Terminator. I was like Arnold, falling out of the sky with all that electricity and all that cosmic crap going on and all these things shooting out of his body, just boom, falling to the earth. And by the time he hit, do you remember, like, all those things just started to go, and he kind of like, it kind of like slowed down and dissipated. And there he was, naked, and didn't know where the hell he was. And he was like shaking his head, trying to figure out what had just happened. That was me when I landed in AA. Nothing says it better than that. There was such a storm of electricity, and what happened? What am I going to do? And what's going to happen? I was just caught in that thing that we talk about, just caught up in the insanity of the wreckage. The most difficult thing was living the life that I did, lying, stuffing, knowing that the things that I did hurt the people that I love the most, but couldn't face it. So I would shove it down and I would drink over it. And I was in bad shape, like most of us. I know I'm like, I mentioned before the meeting, I said, we are just the same salad and just a different dressing. You know, it's like people come from all walks of life, but when we talk about our feelings, how we felt, I know I'm talking to my family because it's not a good place to be. And I remember I was married for 30 years. And my husband was a good husband. We had our standoffs and all those kind of things, but he always provided. He was always faithful. He was always a good provider for me and my family. And when I think of what I put him through and the lies that I told him, I'll tell you one lie that I told him. I became a party girl. I was so full of self-pity and victimhood later on in our marriage. You don't understand me. Always pointing my fingers at what was done to me. I was a victim and I was a martyr. And I looked for sympathy everywhere I could get it. You get some juice out of that. You know, like I had a look at that. You know, when I play the victim, there's a payoff for me because I can tell you my horrible story. I can drink over it and I will get a host of people around me who will pat me on the back, you know. So anyway, I was stuffing all these feelings and all the regret. I remember my husband and I did go to a counselor at one point, and we sat there, and the guilt and the wreckage of my past. Oh, I want to tell you what I told the lie about. I didn't forget that. It was starting to come to the surface, and it was all I could do to just get on my hands and knees and just beg him to forgive me for what had happened, but I could not let it go. I had to hang on to the denial of what I was doing. So I pushed it down again and I muscled through. I muscled through that I am angry with you for what you did. I'm going to continue to live the way that I did. I'm going to live life and just not care about anybody or anything else. Self will run riot 101. That was me at that time. And I mentioned the lying. One example, I got on a plane to Las Vegas to go party. And mind you, I was married for 30 years. We always did everything together. And all of a sudden I'm off and running all over the country doing all this crazy stuff. I remember being in the airport in Las Vegas and there are slot machines everywhere, ring, 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 making all that noise. And I'm on the phone with my husband saying, yeah, I just got here. I'm in somewhere in the Adirondacks on a weekend with some of my girlfriends. We just decided to have a girls' weekend. I was in Las Vegas. And then I had to cover those lies. And the guilt about that stuff just kept building up and building up and building up. And then there was an incident. My husband wanted to kind of work on our marriage. So we went to, he took us, the family, to Florida. And we stayed at this beautiful place on Captiva Island called Tween Waters. It's a beautiful resort. There's a hotel and then there are all these cottages, beautiful pool, all the bells and whistles. And I got really trashed one day at the pool. I was drinking all day. And then we were going back to the room. We were going to have go out to dinner. I was too drunk to go out to dinner. That night was the first time that I saw the shadow people. I woke up and I don't know how to describe it. I read similar circumstances like that in the Came to Believe book, the literature that we had, where people had these crazy experiences. And I think I was awake. I remember seeing the clock on the stand next to the bed. I remember seeing, we had sliders and there was like the curtain was kind of billowing out. I remember seeing the entertainment center. And I looked up and I looked across this where the wall meets the ceiling. And there were four or five shadow people up there. They weren't, and I don't want to make this religious, they weren't demonic presences, is that a word? But they were there and they were looking at me. They had like these little hoodie things on. And I wasn't terrified. I wasn't, you know, like you go to a spooky movie and you have this thing popping out of the closet. There was none of that. It was just, all right, there they are. There they are. And my disease was progressing. And I realized, you know, like when we drink, we don't sleep well. We pass out. All this emotional stuff that starts happening and all the repercussions of that. It's just like a ball of crazy that just gets worse and worse. So anyway, that trip, needless to say, did not work. And then from there, we went to Key West. And oh my goodness, what a disaster that was. I was doing the Duval crawl, going into every bar. My husband gave up, went away. Went back to the room and I got into a lot of trouble and my children were there witness to that. And everything was just starting to snowball. So anyway, I went back up to New York State. Drinking progressed, my behavior, holy mackerel. I was angry with everybody. We ran a business, we ran a marina. I got so angry with one of our customers that I took my keys and made a fist out of my keys and keyed the whole side of their car because they dared to park in front of the ice machine. And I got into a fight with one of our customers because he dropped his gas cap into the lake and wanted me to replace it. And we almost got into a fist fight. And and police had to be called. So I was just so out of control and angry. Foul mouth. Holy moly. I remember someone in when I first started going to meetings said to me, Irene, I have never in all my years in AA ever heard a mouth like yours. And I'm like, all right. So that's where my head was, you know. I have been arrested. I've been fingerprinted. I have a mugshot somewhere in upstate New York, and I was on the 6 o'clock news. So just in case you're thinking I was one of those alcoholics that stood at the ironing board drinking my Chardonnay, my drinking at the end was very public, very loud, very out there, very out there. And that's what it was like. So when I came into AA, for the 1 hour that I was at the meeting, maybe a little bit before, a little bit after, all that crazy was on the outside. That's the only way I can describe it. Because when I came into my first meeting, you all were there and you were normal, normal people. And you talked to one another and there was laughter in the meeting and you were glad to see me. And I didn't have anybody at that time. I didn't have anybody except a few people that I got really loaded with, and just the anger and disappointment and bewilderment from my family, from both of my kids too. Friends gone, and my in-laws had passed away, so they weren't in the picture, but that was it. So people said to me things like, it gets better. I remember sharing in a meeting in the very beginning. I am so happy. I don't smell like wine anymore. I slept last night, you know, instead of passing out. I love to read. I couldn't read anymore. I would just read the same sentence over and over again and just pass out. And I came to a meeting and I shared, I said, hi, I'm Irene. I'm an alcoholic. And I got a good night's sleep and I don't smell bad anymore. And someone came up to me and said, you're on the pink cloud. He goes, just keep coming back, keep coming back. And I did. I went to meetings. Slogans meant so much to me. I got a sponsor. I'm just looking to see. There she is. Tina's here. Tina and Marianne, my friends, my sponsors and friends in upstate New York. Once they figured I was going to stick around, they took me under wing and we went everywhere together. They showed me what AA was all about. One of my sponsors said, people can talk the program, but watch their feet. And those ladies worked a program. They saved my life. They saved my life. And they taught me how to laugh. Oh man, we didn't just laugh. We, migraine headache laughed. We would have laugh over so many things that we would actually get headaches. And two perfect, perfect women. We are still clear here today. We are still close. We still stay in contact. And they know me like nobody else knows me on the planet. And just to be able to say that I have intimate friendships today that know who I am. I was driving the bus all the time. Reminds me of how this fellowship works, how this program works, how the first step works. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, and then our lives have become unmanageable. I can't live without the we today. I lived without the we all of my life because I was going to control, I was going to fix, I was going to tell you what you needed to do. I was like the guy in one of the stories in the big book, or he's in the nut ward making moccasins and he's making a list for his wife, you know, like what to do at home while he was in hospital. That was me. I was so sick and suffering, yet I thought I could run the world. When I finally started to understand what the we meant, I got better. I started to get better. I cannot do this alone. One of my friends in recovery shared his story the other night, and he was a Marine. And he shared the idea of the Marines. We don't leave anybody behind. And that's what AA is all about. And to be able to ask for help and talk about how I feel and what is going on with me and get help to walk through whatever comes down the road, it's just been such a blessing to me. Just a just a little bit about my family history. I hope it's a little bit because I can just like talk forever. I was the oldest of three girls. I grew up in the Pine Barrens in southern New Jersey in a little town kind of smack between Atlantic City and Philadelphia. As a child of the 60s, graduated high school in 1970. And my early childhood memories are of comfort and care. My mom is very, very close to my mom. My dad was a lifer in the Navy, so he was out of the picture a lot. Absolutely loved my dad though. I mean, in love with my dad. He was maybe 5'10", dark hair, green eyes. Kind of sounds like my husband, huh? So my husband was a little bit taller. But I remember my dad coming home on leave and he always cleaned up nice. You know, like he would have a close shave, his hair back. And I remember him holding me in his arms. I was about 3-4 years old. And we danced. And those of you who are of the same age group might remember that song, Hernando's Hideaway. It was one of those tango things. And my dad had me up on his cheek and we were dancing. And I loved my dad. I adored him. However, as my dad's drinking progressed, he was more distant and apart from me. At one point in my recovery, I had the privilege of going to the Karen Foundation. It's a drug and alcohol rehab, and they have a separate program called Breakthrough. And people came there that had to deal with traumatic events in their lives, loss of a loved one, marriages that went awry, anything that people could not get over and past. There was one woman in my group whose husband just one day up and walked out on her, and she could not get over the grief of that loss. One of the exercises we did was she got to reenact the most traumatic thing in that breakup. And for her, it was her husband walking out the door. And she got to choose her go-to, like who she relied on in times of trouble. And hers was Mother Mary. She picked me to be Mother Mary. So I had to stand behind her and put my right hand on her left shoulder while she was reliving this traumatic event. And one of the other people that went on the retreat played her husband walking away. What I didn't realize was I thought I was there to support her. When I saw her so-called husband turn around and walk, I lost myself. I started to sob uncontrollably. It was all I could do to keep from falling on the ground, because what I saw was my dad leaving, my dad abandoning me, my dad going away from me. I used to call it going away from me. He would do things like stop drinking and be there for my sister and I, take us Christmas shopping. And then with a couple of days after that, boom, he was gone. And due to drinking. So I remember, like, I'm building a wall around his heart. You're not, nobody's going to do that to me again. And it set a pattern for me for the rest of my life. Nobody is going to hurt me. If things aren't working out, I'm out of here. That was my mantra. So I found, after working through the 12 steps of the program, I had to come to believe in a higher power greater than myself. I had to make a list of my wrongs. I had to make amends to those people that I had hurt. I had to make a living amends to my family by being sober and being there for them and doing what I could. And I had to start all of that. I had to start doing that immediately. My sponsor said that too. Yeah, I had to work through the steps from this point forward. I had to change. I had to change my personality. I had to be accountable for what I had done. I had to do those things. But for me, I had to look at the root causes, like it says in our book, alcohol was but a symptom. It was a symptom of what was really going on with me. And let me bring it back to my family. My mother, so that was my dad's behavior. My mother, on the other hand, I was raised in church. She was very there, didn't want for anything. However, she was a hoverer and a controller. And you will do this because this is good for you. I didn't have any choice. I didn't have a voice. And I felt invisible. And the way I did that, I would rebel and get angry and fight against her control. So I was a perfect little mess to up to the point when I took my first drink and all that was like, hey, we're good here. You know, I didn't have any self-doubt. I was pretty, I was popular, you know, and I know I'm preaching to the choir because in one form or another, I heard it over and over again in Alcoholics Anonymous. So alcohol for me was the solution until it wasn't the solution anymore, until the jackpots, like we hear, got worse and worse and worse. But it did work for a while. I never called it drinking. It was partying. Where's the party? You know? And while underneath that party veneer was, whoa, what a mess was going on in there. And you know, too, my little sister passed away when she was 6 years old. She had leukemia. She had Down syndrome. And apparently leukemia is one of those things that go hand in hand with that. And I remember then, it was then that my dad's drinking really took off. And it was then that I started to look outside of my home and kind of ran away. I just don't know where I'd be today if my higher power did not land me in AA. You know, like I said, at the end of my drinking, I just walked into a meeting. I called a friend that I knew many, many years ago, who I went to. He was a counselor, and it turned out that he was in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I told him what was going on. And he said, get to a meeting, you know, get to a meeting, tell them what's going on, and you'll find help there. And he said, the folks that you will meet there aren't so much interested in your emotional stuff. They don't want you to drink. Nothing good would ever come to me until I put down alcohol. You know, that's, you know, like we build that that life, and stopping drinking had to be the very, very first thing. And after that, all good things happened for me. And I wanted to say something too about my higher power. You know, being raised in church, I had a concept of God. I loved God when I was a little girl. Like I told you, I was raised in the Lutheran faith and went to Sunday school, went to church, all holidays celebrated in the church. And was in the choir and in the junior choir and the adult choir. And, you know, I was a church kid. What happened though, my concept of God was always that God was out there somewhere and I better like come up to standard to get God's approval. And since I was always so hard on myself and so judgmental of myself, and I had a lot of that in my family, that was my concept of God, really. You know, I've heard over and over again, our concept of God is what we think our parents are, because that's what we have as our model. And I just had the wrong model for what I thought my higher power was. What I have learned in sobriety and in my recovery is that, and as I learned to love myself in this program, I don't want to sound psychological, all that psychobabble crap, but I had to let myself off the hook for my behavior. I love this expression. If you want to give somebody a glass of orange juice, you got to have oranges. And I didn't have any oranges to give anybody because my concept of my higher power, my concept of myself was really skew, like askew. So once I realized in recovery that I wasn't a bad person, but I was sick. I had a lot of mistaken beliefs about who and what I was. And once I realized that I was simply mistaken and simply looking at the world through the eyes of someone that had a belief system that was incorrect, based on parenting, based on what came at me left and right, based on my drinking, based on all kinds of stuff. And it had become a perfect brew of self-loathing when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. Doing the work, and my sponsor said to me, "You'll get better, but it takes time. This I must earn." And I learned that I had to work for my sobriety. When I was told I had to work for my sobriety early on, oh man, because I was spoiled, I was entitled, I was a victim, and I wanted somebody to fix me and make it all go away. When I had to work for what I got, that was a real comeuppance for me. There are no free rides in recovery. There are no free rides in getting sober. I have to do the work. And my sponsor said to me, "I am here for you. I'm here to help you with your recovery. I'm here to show you what the steps are, but this is your recovery. You have to do the work." Holy moly. So pretty much boil it down, plain and simple, I had to grow up. I had to learn to become an adult in this program and take responsibility for myself and to think of others before I thought of myself. Pretty simple stuff, isn't it? I didn't have a clue. I did not have a clue how to do this. So that's what AA has given me. Back to my higher power. The relationship I have with my higher power today is total acceptance and love. And I'm so grateful that in this program, and we can all come in with all our different concepts of that higher power. There is no way that I cannot be in the presence of that higher power, no matter what, no matter what comes, that I am completely loved and guided. There is no judgment. There is nothing except love. And I can say today, I can tell my higher power, "I love you." And what I get back is "I love you too." And you are a shining light. Oh my goodness, it blows me away. And I don't have to do anything for that. Just have to be here. I don't have to do anything to deserve that. It has always been there. I have told this before. I love stories and I love parables. There's a story about this little snail, and he's walking around. Got a few minutes left. He's walking around on the grass. He's crying his eyes out because he can't find his home. He's lost out in this grassy field with the dew. And he comes upon this old shaman snail with the long beard, and he's kind of, and he comes up to the old knowledgeable sage snail, and he says, I can't find my home. I can't find my home. Where is it?" And he says, "My son, you have been carrying your home with you all this time." "And I have been carrying my home with me all this time." Like it says in the big book, we all have that concept, that idea of a higher power of God within us. It is just that. It is covered over. It is veiled over by our stories, by our circumstances, by our guilt, by our shame, by our whatever, anger, all of those. It's like that, like I was talking about Arnold, all that stuff hides the truth of who we are. I am not a religious person. I am not, you know, espousing any particular faith. I think that that concept of a higher power is beyond that. It's beyond any belief system or anything that you can read or write about. for me, it has been experienced. It is as real to me as like tapping on this book, that God is always there. God has always been there and has always, always wanted for this to happen. In your introduction, we talk about having a spiritual awakening, how we found God. Alcoholics Anonymous is how I found the God of my understanding. And there's another teacher that I listened to. I think it's St. John the Divine. He said, there must be great despair before there is happiness. And that's what happened for me. I had to be at the bottom of the bottom without any answers, without any recourse, without any, yeah, buts, you don't understand. I, for a moment, there had to be a crack in my ego where I was allowing of something different to come in. That was my spiritual awakening in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it just continues to grow and get better. It's just amazing to me today that that relationship is there. I always wanted it. I was always crying for the moon, but it's rock solid today. Do I get wrapped around the axle? Yeah. And things happen. I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous that I don't have to react. I don't have to run away from what is happening. I can walk through it. One of the other great benefits of being in recovery too is that I learned where my boundaries are. I learned that just as I am powerless over alcohol, I am powerless over everybody and everything else. I am no one's higher power. I am not here to fix or give advice to anybody about what they should do or what they shouldn't do. People around me who are struggling or having issues today, I can say, I think, three things. I love you with all my heart. I am so sorry you are going through this. I am really sure you are going to figure this out. That's all I have to offer, with the exception of I also can be an example of what it is to be sober, not just alcohol, but emotionally sober. As a grown-up, as an adult. So that's pretty much where I'd like to end my sharing my story. It's been a real privilege to be here. I am so grateful for all of you and all that I have learned in this fellowship. And it doesn't stop, like all of us. We are a work in progress. But if I keep showing up and keep listening and keep in touch with those that help me, life will continue to just get better and better. So I really thank you for setting this up today. Really grateful.